Tonight, however, we have Hanif Qureshi. Welcome, Hanif.
Thank you.
Hanif is the author of My Beautiful Laundrette, The Buddha of Suburbia, and The Black Album, amongst others. And we'll be reading from his new collection of stories tonight, Love in a Blue Time, which again is maybe a comment on the last 18 years. After the reading, there'll be quite a longish opportunity to ask questions. The reading will last about 20 minutes, and the questions and answers will be about half an hour. So that's it, really. Ladies and gentlemen, Hanif Qureshi.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Turn it up. Is it not? Oh yeah. Okay. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. Okay. This is a bit from a story called The Flies. One morning, after a disturbed night, a year after they moved into the flat, and with their son only a few months old, Baxter goes into the box room where he and his wife have put their wardrobes, opens the door to his, and picks up a pile of sweaters. Unfolding them one by one, he discovers that they all appear to have been crocheted. Not only that, the remaining threads are smeared with a viscous yellow deposit, like egg yolk, which has stiffened the remains of the ruined garments. He shakes out the flies that have gorged on his clothes and stamps on the tiny crisp corpses. Other flies, only stupefied, dart out past him and position themselves on the curtains, where they appear threateningly settled, just out of reach. Baxter hurriedly rolls up the clothes in plastic bags and, retching, thrusts them into the bottom of a dustbin on the street. He goes to the shops and packs his wardrobe with fly killer. He sprays the curtains with antiseptic. He disinfects the rugs. He stands in the shower a long time. With water streaming down him, nothing can adhere to his skin. He doesn't tell his wife about the incident, thinking at first that he won't bother her with such an unimportant matter. He has, though, noticed flies all over the flat, which his wife, it seems, has not noticed. If he puts mothballs in his pockets and has to mask this odour with scents and goes about imagining that people are sniffing as he passes them, he doesn't care, since something about the attack has disturbed him. He wants to keep it from himself as much as from her. But at different times of the day, he needs to check the wardrobe and suddenly rips open the door as if to surprise an intruder. At night, he begins to dream of ragged, bullet-shaped holes chewed in fetid fabric, and of creamy white eggs hatching in darkness. In his mind, he hears the amplified rustle of gnawing, chewing, devouring. And when this wakes him, he rushes into the box room to shake his clothes or stab at them with an umbrella. On his knees, he scours the dusty corners of the flat for the nest or bed where the contamination must be incubating. When one night his wife catches him with his nose down against the skirting board and explains to her what has happened, she isn't much concerned. Still, he does want to discuss it with her, and he asks an acquaintance to babysit. The two of them will go out to dinner. Before the birth, he and his wife had been together a few months, and then serious lovers for a year. Since the child, their arguments have increased, which Baxter imagines is natural, as there is a lot to think about. But their arguments have also taken on a new tone. There was a moment recently when they looked at one another and said, simultaneously, that they wished with all their souls that they had never met. He had wanted a baby because it was something to want. Other people had them and seemed to like them. She agreed because she was 35. Perhaps they no longer believed that they would find the one person who would change everything for them. Wanting to feel tidy, Baxter extracts a suit from his wardrobe. On its hanger, he holds it up to the light. It seems complete, as it did the last time he looked, 2 hours before. But while removing his shoes, Baxter turns his back, and when he looks again, only the hanger remains. Surely a thief has rushed into the room and filched his jacket and trousers. But no, the suit is on the floor, a small pyramid of charred ash. His other suits disintegrate at one touch, and flies hurl themselves at his face before chasing into the air. Over dinner, they drink wine, eat food, and look around, surprised to see so many people out and about, some of whom are even smiling. Although he has prepared several subjects to keep the conversation going, his wife has become sarcastic, and she says she's long thought it time he acquired a new wardrobe. She hopes the involuntary clear-out will lead to sartorial improvement. That night, tired by pettiness and their inability to amuse one another anymore, she sits in the box room and he walks the child up and down. He hears a cry and he runs to her. She has unlocked her wardrobe to discover that her coats, dresses and knitwear have been replaced by a row of yellowish tatters, and on the floor are piles of dead flies. He helps her to bed, where the child sleeps between them. Just as they never kiss now when they attempt to make love, he rarely looks into her eyes. But as he takes her arm, he notices a black fly emerge from her cornea and hop onto her eyelash. Next morning, he telephones a firm of exterminators. With unusual dispatch, they agree to send an operative. You need the service, they say, before Baxter has even described the symptoms. He and his wife obviously have a known condition. This is a relief. They watch the van arrive. The operative opens its rear doors and strides into the hall. He's big and unkempt in green overalls with thick glasses. He listens keenly, examines the remains of their clothes, and says at last, "You two, you need the total service." Baxter's wife and the baby are ordered out. Baxter runs to fetch a box in order to watch through the window. The operative dons a grey mask. A transparent bottle of greenish liquid is strapped to his side. From the bottle extends a rubber tube with a metal sieve on the end. Also feeding into the sieve is a flat pack of greyish-looking putty attached to a piece of string around the man's neck. On one thigh is a small engine, which he starts with a bootlace. While it runs, he strikes various practiced poses and holds them like a strangely attired dancer. The rattling noise and force is terrific. Not a living cretin could proceed through the curtains of sprayed venom. The operative leaves behind, in a corner, an illuminated, electrified blue pole in a flower pot for protection, as he puts it. "How long will we need protection?" said Baxter. "I'll look at it the next couple of times. It'll have to be recharged." "We'll need the full operative service again," says Baxter. The operative is offended. "We're not called operatives now," he said. "We're microbe consultants." "By the way, you'll be needing a pack." "What's that?" From the van, he fetches a packet comprised of several sections, each containing different potions. Baxter glances over the instructions. "I'll put it on the bill," said the operative, "along with the curtain atomizer and this one for the carpet. You better take three packs, just in case." "One will be fine, thanks," said Baxter. "No," said the operative. "I've noticed your wife. She looks nice. Don't you want to protect her?" "I do." "You won't want to run out in the middle of the night then?" "No." "Good." The total is formidable. Baxter writes the check. She puts out the potions. The smell stings their eyes and makes them cough. The baby develops red sores, but they rub cream into the marks and he sleeps contentedly. Baxter goes to the shops. His wife cooks a meal. They eat together and then watch with some pleasure the saucers in which the dying flies are writhing. It's better than television. Lately, particularly when the baby cries, Baxter's been dawdling out on the street. A couple of the neighbors have suggested that the new couple stop by for a drink. Leaving his wife and child in safety, Baxter will go out that very night, wearing whatever he can assemble, a suit of armor, if need be. He starts at the top of the street, wearing an acrylic cardigan purchased from the charity shop, inedible combat trousers, and a PVC coat. The first couple Baxter visits have three children. Both adults work, designing household objects of some kind. Kettles, Baxter presumes, but it could be chair legs. He can't quite remember. He rings the bell. After what seems from within a considerable amount of hurried movement, the bearded man opens the door. Baxter introduces himself, offering, at the same time, to go away. Baxter, celebrating that night, joins him, taking half a glass of whiskey. But it is a disconcerting conversation, since it is so dark in the room that Baxter can't see the other man. The woman, harassed but eager to join in, comes to the foot of the stairs before the children's yells from upstairs interrupt them. Then she stomps up again, crying out, "Oh, right, right, it must be my turn again." "Will they never stop?" shouts the man. "But how can they sleep?" she says. "The atmosphere is suffocating us." "All of us," says the man. "So you've noticed. How could I not?" Baxter, growing accustomed to the gloom, notices a strange gesture that the bearded man makes. Dipping his fingers into his glass, the bearded man flicks the liquid across his face and, in places, rubs it in. He does the same with his arms, even as they talk, as if the alcohol is a lotion rather than an intoxicant. The man stands up and says, "Come on, let's get out of here. We're going." And he's hustling Baxter by the arm of his black PVC coat when the woman flies down the stairs and begins to dispute with her husband. Baxter doesn't attend to what they're saying, although other couples' arguments now have the ability to fascinate him, because he is captivated by a fly which detaches itself from the end of the man's tongue, crawls up the side of its nose, and settles on his eyebrow, where it joins a companion, unnoticed until now, already grazing on the hairy ridge. Baxter backs away, but he takes a wrong turn in the hall. He opens a door and notices an object standing in the bath. It's a glowing blue pole, like the one in his flat, and it seems to be pulsating. He looks closer and realizes that this effect is caused by the movement of flies. He's reaching out to touch it when he hears a voice behind him, and he turns to see the couple. "Are you looking for something?" they say. He doesn't want to look at them, but he can't help himself, and as he moves past, they drop their eyes, and at that moment, the woman blushes for shame. He isn't ready to go home, but he can't stay out on the street. Walking down the road, he sees figures in a window before a hand drags the curtain across. He has barely knocked on the door before he is in a room with a glass in his hand. It's a disparate crowd at the party, comprising, he guesses, shy foreign students, the sort of girls who join cults, an old man in a tweed suit, and people dancing with their shoes off. His neighbor is drunk, but oddly watchful. She puts her arms. Thank you. His neighbor is drunk, but oddly watchful. She puts her arms around his neck, which discomforts him, as if there is some need in him that she has noticed, though he can't see what it is. "We didn't think you'd come," said the woman. "Your wife doesn't speak to us. She's charming to some people, but how is the flat?" "It's fine," said Baxter. "It's not too bad." Becoming aware of an itching on his forehead, he slaughters a fly between finger and thumb. She says, "Are you sure?" He feels another fly creeping across his cheek. She takes the index finger of his right hand and leads him into a conservatory at the back of the house. It's cold, there is no music. She shoves down her clothes, bends forward over the arm of a chair, and he slides the finger she's taken possession of, and two others, into her. It's a luxurious and well-deserved oblivion. Surely happiness is forgetting who you are. But as they move together, he notices a familiar caustic smell. He looks about and sees bowls of white powder placed on the floor. Another contains a greenish-blue sticky substance. Injured specks move drowsily in the buckets. He extracts his hand and holds it out. Up to the wrist, it's alive with flies. He groans. "Oh dear," she says, looking round. "Little babies are hungry tonight." She flaps at them unconcernedly. "Isn't there a remedy?" he says. "People live with it," she said. "They do." "That's the best thing," she said. "It's also the worst. Or they work, or they drink. People all over the world endure bacteria." "But surely," said Baxter, "surely there's a poison brew or blue light that will deter them." "There is," she says, "of a kind. The potions do work," she says, "but you have to replace them with different makes. Imported is best, but expensive. Of course, the flies get used to it, and it only maddens them. In this street, we keep the flies away with passion." "Passion? Where there is passion," she said, "you don't notice anything, do you?" He lies over for her from behind. He says he can't believe that these things are just inevitable, that there isn't somewhere a solution. She says, "Most of them have got flies around here, except the newlyweds and the adulterers. They've got other things. 18 months it takes," she says. "If you're lucky, you get 18 months of love, and then you get the flies." She explains that the flies are the only secret that everyone keeps. Other problems can be paraded and boasted of, but this is an unacceptable shame. She says, do you hate your wife? Sorry? You can tell me. He whispers in her ear. He whispers that it is dawning on him, as love dawns on people, that at times he does hate his wife. He hates the way she cuts up an apple. He hates her hands. He hates her tone of voice and the words he knows she'll use. He hates her clothes, her eyelids, and everyone she knows. Her perfume makes him nauseous. He hates the things he loved about her, hates the way he put himself in thrall to her. He hates the kindnesses she showed him, as if she's asking for something. And he sees, too, that it doesn't matter much that you don't love someone until you have a child with them. And he understands, too, how important hatred is, what a strong, sustaining feeling it is, a screen, perhaps, to stop him pitying his wife and himself and falling into a pit of misery. His neighbour nods as he shivers with shame and fear at what she's provoked him into saying. She says to him, my husband and I are thinking of starting a microbe business ourselves. Are you interested? Thank you, I'll stop there. Thanks.
We'll take questions now. I'm going to hold this, I think. We'll take questions now for about half an hour. Is this working? Good. I'll just take it from anybody in the audience.
I know sometimes people don't like to be asked about the past, so I'll get this question out of the way, but it's always puzzling me. Why did you let someone else do the stage version of My Beautiful Dark Bride?
The stage version? You mean the film? Oh, did you see that? I didn't see that.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you, it seems a strange choice that a white Anglo-Irish male to play. I was going to ask you if you've done justice to it.
I didn't see it. He just took the film and wrote it as a stage play. I thought that was a bit odd, myself. But I never saw it, and I just... It was actually Naveen Andrews, who was in The Buddha of Suburbia, who's now in The English Patient, he was in it. And he kept saying to me, oh, I wish I'd had that part, I wanted to be in that. So I thought, well, you can't really do that with films because you can't reshoot them. So I said, well, they're going to do a play of it, you go and be in the play and then you can see whether you can do it better. I didn't see it. No, I couldn't bear to. I rather like the idea of just giving your work to other people and then saying, well, do what you like, you know, you can do a ballet with it or, you know, do it as a poem. I thought it seemed a bit mean to say no, you know, they wanted to do it as a play. I thought they should have done it as a musical with people dancing around the laundrette, like West Side Story, only with washing machines. But, no, I didn't see it.
I can't keep raking you all the time. Don't forget your Guinness. Special order.
Why did you decide, if it was any kind of conscious decision, why did you decide to write The Flies in present tense?
I just wanted to fiddle around with tenses. I suppose when I sit down to write, I always write in the past tense automatically, because that's what most people do. And then I just started writing it in the present tense, and it seemed to have more movement and more action, more activity and more immediacy to it, I suppose.
What immediacy to you? I don't know, because when I was reading it, I couldn't help thinking that perhaps you'd written it like that to distance yourself from the underlying subject matter.
I'm not aware of that. I don't know whether the tense would make any difference to that, really. I just like to muck about, you know. I wrote a story about a piece of shit, you know, in this collection. And then I wrote a story about people who've got flies, and it just seemed that I hadn't done that kind of thing before, and it seemed interesting to see whether I could make anything of it. And then you think, I'll make it more difficult by writing it in another tense, and so on. And so you just look for things when you write them that kind of keep you going, that interest you, you know, that you haven't done before, just to keep yourself going somehow. So, and many of those choices, and they're not really philosophical choices, they're just sort of, you just fiddle around and you think, oh, that seems right to me. And then when people ask you about them, you can't really say why, but it just seemed interesting to me to do in some way, or yeah, it made it move in a way. Yes.
Talk a bit about that, but what it is that makes you want to use invented things in order to arrive at truth, and what kind of truth you feel is only accessible through that route?
By telling fibs.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm fascinated by lies and how useful lies are, and how we have to live in a truth-telling community in order to get along at all, and how we have to tell lies in order to protect ourselves and other things for all kinds of reasons. And then you can see that telling stories is kind of sophisticated lying, but obviously there's some other thing that is being conveyed, that's being told. And just telling stories, really. It's to do with... Yes, I don't know, it's to do with making things up, which I've always enjoyed. And when you make things up, you're sort of omnipotent, aren't you? It makes you feel very powerful. And then you can seduce somebody else with a story into believing in your world. And that activity has always interested me. I suppose because I grew up in the suburbs, and it was quite violent down there, and it was always unpleasant most of the time. And so telling stories or telling lies somehow seemed a way of protecting myself, or of creating a world in which I could live, or I was the boss, I was the king. You know, I knew I was all right in that world, which was the stories that I told. And then you could make the world and exchange the world with other people on your own terms. They come into your world when you tell lies, the lies of storytelling. I think it's something to do with that, but I'm not sure. I was an outsider, yeah. When I was growing up, I was an outsider because I was an Asian boy, a Paki boy on the street, and everybody else was white. And I was an outsider because people say to you all the time, where do you come from? And you say, over there, you know. And they say, no, where do you really come from? And you say, well, I really come from over there. And then you have to explain yourself all the time, and then you think about who you are. And I was an outsider because I was interested in books and all that stuff, culture, as they call it, in universities. And the people around me weren't. So I thought that if I could write books, I could get away to a place where I wasn't an outsider, which was London, which is what I did. And so, yes, I did feel outside, because people put me in that position all the time. And then I saw that being outside was that you could integrate all the outside bits, you see what I mean, all the strange parts of yourself you couldn't fit together, you could somehow integrate through writing about it somehow, that it made things whole, that you didn't feel so jagged inside, you know. But I did feel an outsider, and I hated the people who made me feel an outsider, and it's very painful to hate people all the time, and it sort of stifles you and makes you feel exhausted. And I wanted to get out and get over that, so writing somehow was a way of curing myself of being an outsider, because in the writing world I was on the inside. You're always on the inside of your own imagination, at least. But yes, I was an outsider, and I identified with other writers, I suppose, usually American writers or black American writers, like Baldwin and Richard Wright and so on, but also other writers like Kerouac and so on, who were outside. And it always seemed to me that pop culture was about being outside. You know, Elvis was outside until he joined the army, you know. The Beatles were outside, and you know, until they got the MBE. And I felt that pop culture was very important to me because it was a representation of outsiderness. And now everybody's an outsider, apart from Andrew Lloyd Webber. Well, I was never in between. I have both. You can look at it as being an in-between. I suppose I was in-between. People would say to me, you're in-between. But I had a bit of both, you might say. And you might say that I was fortunate in that sense, that my father came from a middle-class Indian background, and my mother came from a lower-middle-class English background. And I, you know, all those streams united together in my mind to produce me, who then made sense of it through writing. I think that you only feel in between when other people make you feel in between. And anyway, everybody's in between in another sense. You realize that there are parts of all of us that feel outside. There are parts of all of us that feel in between. And we all have to make sense of all the fragments of ourselves and put them together in some sense. So you might feel outside or in between racially or sexually or whatever it is you are. But in a sense, you realize that everybody's made up of bits and pieces that they make into a person, which is what they are. And then when I sort of saw that, I didn't feel so as if I was sticking out so much somehow. Yes, I don't want to be cynical. Somebody wrote me a letter the other day saying he liked my book, but he thought it was cynical. I don't want to be cynical. I like innocence and all that. It does seem cynical sometimes, but I think there is a kind of innocence in it, really. I suppose you're cynical. It seems cynical because, in a sense, one believes things. You know, if you wouldn't hate people, say, that's, you know, there's a passage in that piece about hatred. You wouldn't hate people if you were really cynical because you couldn't be bothered. Hatred is such a strong and such a clear feeling, for instance. So I hope there isn't too much cynicism. I suppose I liked cynicism because it seemed the opposite of earnestness, and I always hated earnestness somehow. But I hope I'm not cynical, and I wouldn't like to be. I'd like to be cured of it.
In a blue time, but currently the collection, there's a sense of people trying to get through a really bad place, whose lives kind of blighted by something very terrible that's come upon them. And there's a feeling that some of the time you're suggesting that this darkness is the 80s, it's sort of cultural fascism, and sometimes you're suggesting that it's more something. More something within and between people that belongs to the future. Did you intend both of those?
I suppose I started out writing about young men who are rather innocent and rather hopeful, and the Buddha is about that, and My Beautiful Laundrette is sort of about that, and maybe the Black Album is as well. And this stuff is darker, it's blue or it's black, you know. And yes, it's more melancholy. And I thought that, you know, if I feel melancholy, I'm going to write melancholy stories, you know, and I'm not going to try and dress it up. And I suppose I did feel melancholy, as one does when one gets older, you know, and you realize somehow that you're in the front line and your parents can't protect you from what the world's like. And then you realize all kinds of awful truths about your life when you get to be middle-aged, I suppose. It seems kind of final or terminal in some way. And I thought, well, fuck it, I'll just write that down, you know. And I can't, you know, and I'll make it as dark as I want. And that was quite a new thing for me, because I'd always tried to write quite lightly. And I thought, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm actually rather cheerful, and I think you have to be cheerful in order to write really dark stuff, actually. And if you weren't cheerful, you probably wouldn't be able to write it down at all. But yes, I wanted to write about the awfulness of things, as well as I want to write about awful things in a rather light way, in a way that preserves somehow what's amusing about life, what's funny about life, because life is funny, particularly when you're a child. My parents were hilarious to me, you know, when I was a child, because they were so big, particularly my father, who's a very big, kind of domineering, extravagant, large man, and we just pissed ourselves laughing, my sister and I, in order to control him. And so the world has always seemed to me to be a funny place, and if it's funny, it's not so dangerous. But of course, it is also dangerous and frightening, and somehow making, you know, writing about how frightening and dangerous and awful it is, and seeing that it's absurd and ridiculous and people are silly, somehow I've always wanted to keep all those things going at once, if possible.
Thank you.
if you become famous for writing films and novels and stories, press then becomes interested in your private life, your interviews about your domestic arrangements and so on. Do you feel they're almost more interested in that than your writing?
Yes, much more interested. When they come around my house, I always get the photographs out. And they always describe the photographs. They always say he's got lots of photographs of his children, you know, and I think, oh, I'm glad I put that right there, you know, because they always just, and they describe your kitchen as well, so I always tidy up before they come round. And then, and they've always read all the old cuttings as well, you know, and they always repeat all the old stuff, because they're so lazy, you know, some bloke from the Observer came, you know, some fat lazy slob came around my house and talked much more than I did. He talked for hours. And then they go away and write all this stuff about you, and they've only met you for half an hour, and you think, then you realise it's what you have to do, you know, to get people to get to your books. What you want is somebody to read your book, and then there's pure contact, you know. You wrote it on your own and they read it on their own, and that's when it happens, and that's what you want to do. And you do have to go through all this absurd stuff, which is actually rather degrading, I suppose, and rather foolish, because people think things about you that you think are not true. And then you realise that, you know, there are versions of all of us that exist in the world that we can't control, you know? All of us exist in other people's minds only in versions, you know? And, you know, you find someone, you get them to love you, and you think they've got the right version, you know? And you they're straight about what you're like, but of course, that escapes you too, and you can never hold a version of yourself in the other person's mind that you want, you know? And then you realise that, you realise it's sort of hopeless, isn't it? You know, that you can't get any kind of security, so then you sort of give up. Yes, and it is rather foolish. I mean, I wouldn't write something about somebody's private life after meeting them for half an hour, you know, and say, unconsciously, he said, unconsciously, Hanif wants so-and-so, and you think, how do you, I don't even know what I want, not even, you know, not even my therapist knows what I want unconsciously, so who knows? But yes, it's part, books have become, you know, Tolstoy didn't do it, he didn't go around, but it's part of the modern world, what, you know, how you sell your books. And I think that's what you want, is to get them to people, and so they can read them, and then that's when it happens. And that's the point of it, I suppose. But it is rather demeaning.
Could you repeat that question?
Why did you do the
Fable Book of Pop? It was done because I did it with John Savage, and he'd become a friend of mine, and I really liked him. And I used to go to John's house, and he had tons, thousands of books about pop, and magazines and cuttings, and he did a wonderful book called England's Dreaming. And obviously I've always liked pop music, and I've always liked writing about pop. They're my two favourite things, you know. And so I suggested that we did this book together, of writing about pop music from the beginning, from, I think it's from Sinatra up until the recent present. And I thought it would be just good fun for me and John to sit around and talk about pop music and read books that you know, that we enjoyed and so on. It did become rather grueling in the end, because most of the writing about pop music is terrible, you know, and you've just got to get through it all. And all that was rather difficult. But really I did it because I liked him. That's why.
I was going to say, how do you think your attitudes towards relationships, love, and you're talking about versions that people have.
Yes. The versions of you that exist in other people that you know, yes.
I was just wondering how, because as you were saying, you know, I mean, the short stories are much more melancholy in tone, and I was just wondering how, and they're all to do with friendship or love in some way.
Yes. I suppose I just felt that you know, when you get to be middle-aged, you've known people for a long time, usually, and you've, if you've met people at university or when you're younger, there is some duration. And I'm very interested in how relationships sustain over a period of time, or don't sustain over a period of time, and how you change and they change, and how the period in which you live also changes too, the politics. So I'm interested really in what happens between people, looking at friendship, looking at lovers, looking at haters, and all that fascinates me now in a way that it didn't before. I suppose because before I wrote about outsiders, I wrote about people trying to get into relationships, and now when you get to be middle-aged, you write about people trying to get out of them. But yes, what it's like to know another person, what it's like to have them know you. You know, how do you live with another person? How do they live with you? How do you keep it going? How do you not? You know, and all of that. It just seems fascinating to me and new to me as a writer, because as I say, I felt before that I was kind of writing a bit, I suppose, from the outside. Yes, as somebody looking in on England and looking on in on other people's relationships, which is what children do with their parents, clearly. Sometimes I take people completely whole and chuck them in something. That happened, I had an uncle who had laundrettes, and he sort of ended up whole. And he used to take me around his laundrettes, and I used to write down the things that he said. And some of his speeches went into the film, and he was a sort of Saeed Jaffrey character, sort of boosted up, you know, on the good days. And you can do that. And he was rather pleased. He liked the film, and he said, used to go around saying, you know, they've made a film about me, I'm in a film. His wife wasn't pleased, but he was pleased. But usually what happens, you take somebody's ear, you take somebody's hair, somebody else's nose, and you mix them all up. You can't really just take somebody completely and put them in a story, because as soon as you do that, they begin to change, and then you use, you know, it's all mixed up with imagination and play and fantasy and, you know, fitting the bit into the whole story and getting it going and all that. So then they become somebody else. But yes, if you're a writer, you use the world that you have around you. You don't have anything else. You know, the world becomes material sometimes. You know, as it is for all of us. We use other people, we use books, we use films. We, you know, we swallow them, we digest them, we make something of them, we change them. And that's what writers do, except they do it in a rather more public way. But you can't sort of, yeah. You sort of have to bite the bullet and say, look, you know, that story is so great that you told me last night about that personal thing, but I can't, I've got to put it in a story, I can't help it, it's fantastic. It's just what I need for my book, you know. But it always does become different in some way, you do transform it. But yes, that does, it is what writers do, but we all do that, we all gossip, you know. Everyone's always saying to us, you know, don't tell this to anybody else. And then you tell it to somebody else, and it goes round, and it becomes something else. So we're all, writing is a kind of gossip, isn't it? Higher gossip, some people say, but I would say lower gossip. No, I didn't. Well, I don't work for him. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's not my job to tell his version of the world. If he doesn't like the way that I represent Asians, let's say, or the way I represent Germans, or the way I represent French women, or the way I represent Danish princes, or whatever it is one writes about, if he doesn't like it, he's got to tell his own version too. You know what I mean? I don't work for him. I can't. You can, if you're a writer, you can only work in your own way and tell the stories you have to say, you know? And that's all you can do. You wouldn't be able to write at all if you felt somehow somebody was sitting behind you saying, you know, if he's an Asian, he's got to be a nice person, you know. If he's a skinhead, he's got to be horrible. I mean, it would all be awful. It would be impossible. Asian people to me are the same as anybody else, you know, because I'm one of them. So I don't think that Asians should be represented as being this or that, particularly on principle. I can't see what the principle would be. And it's very important to betray people when you write about them as well, you know. Asian people are just like everyone else. There's no you know, there's no difference in that sense, and you couldn't write, and I don't care what he thinks. It's both. It comes to me. You find something in the world. If you're a writer, you look for stories. One day I had flies in my cupboard, you know, and they ate all my suits. And then I got mothballs, and they came back, and they ate all my suits and other suits. And I thought this was strange, and it became a story. You know, my dad was a Buddhist sometimes, although he was a Muslim, and he used to dress up like George Harrison sometimes. And during the day, he was a packy on the street, and at night, he was a guru, and that amused me, and I could see that there was something in it for me as a writer. You know, that's funny to me, and interesting. So you look for stories, and you find them in the world because, you know, you're a writer, and that's what you do. And they attach themselves to you. And you can find them everywhere all the time, if that's your job, just like, I don't know, alcoholics find pubs, or... priests find brothels, or whatever. You look for what you need, and you find it, and you use it, and then you can see that there's something in there for you, and then it develops, it grows, sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't, but you just begin to see things in that kind of way, in a storytelling mode, becomes instinctive. Oh, I just have this theory that when I was a kid, I used to read all the time because I was hiding from things. People thought it was because I was, you know, scholarly. But then I realized it was because I couldn't face the world, and I decided to stop reading books so much and try and face other people in some way. That reading books had given me a lot in my life, and I could, for all sorts of reasons, both personally and as a writer, that I just knocked off doing it for a while, because mostly because I had children and I had less time. I was also less interested in, you know, it's just a phase I was going through, I think. But I do still read sometimes.
But has that been part of the reason why you then, to sort of lack of patience for novels as well as you writing short stories?
I write films and I write TV serials and I write short stories because, and novels, because each of them uses a different part of your head, you know? It's like, I don't know, if you're a painter, you might make ceramics one day, or might make sculpture, or you might, you know, do a sketch or whatever. It just interests another, gets another part of you going. If you write a story, you can write it really quickly. And it's just a moment, a photograph, a sketch, or something glimpsed. And there you go, you've done it. You write it down and that's it. And you think, good, I've done that. But I couldn't put that in a novel, I couldn't put that in a film. It would only work in a story. So then you do that. And then you work on a novel for different reasons, because it's obviously a sustained narrative and so on. So I like to keep myself, you know, it's very boring being a writer. I spend all day on my own with the door closed writing. And I like to do different things in the room because it keeps me going, interested, alive. Yes, that's why I do them all. And they're all interesting in different ways, you know. Movies are interesting because of other people. Other people change them around all the time, you know. I've just written a movie, just made a movie called My Son the Fanatic, which is going to Cannes. You know, and the American producer said to me the other day, love your movie, kiss me all over, cuddle me and everything, the way they do. And then he said, it's a great movie. And then he said, well, we must change the title. And I think we should definitely change the end as well, you know. And we need more of that character as well, you know, the fat one. Can't we have more of him at the end? And you think, oh, all right, you know, maybe I will, maybe I won't. So movies, that happens with movies, obviously doesn't happen with novels. Doesn't happen with short stories, and so, you know, you do all of them for different reasons. On the 80s, cynicism. I suppose it was a cynical period in some sense. Yes, it was a period in which people didn't take much interest in other people and were mostly interested in money and were greedy, which agreed seems to me to be an odd quality. Possibly, yes, it is a book partly about that, that came out of that and may reflect that. But I wouldn't say that all the stories are cynical. Certainly there's a story called We're Not Jews in it, which is, seems to me to be a very honest and rather straightforward story, actually, about childhood. So, you know, I wouldn't want it to get around that that it's all like that somehow, because I don't think it is. Yes. Well, I suppose, yes, the 60s was very important for my generation, and it seemed like a rather glorious, 60s and 70s, it seemed like a rather glorious time, because there were other values which were being celebrated, which were to do with a certain kind of authenticity or creativity, and the 80s seemed vulgar in comparison. So that character, yes, is disillusioned already, but I wouldn't say that was true of me. Yet.
Take two more questions before the end. Okay.
I'm just curious what your opinion of Sammy and Rosie is on how it turned out, and have you been on the reception?
If Sammy and Rosie get laid?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that for a long time, that one. But that was a really crazy film, yes, and it was really rather fragmented and strange, and we sort of put loads of stuff in, and I don't know really. It was, sometimes you're bursting to say all these things, but you can't quite find the form in which to get them right, you know. I had that problem with my film London Kills Me too, you know. It's as if I was searching for a form, and but the subject was kind of bursting everywhere, and I couldn't quite get it all in the right place and the right order. So I think bits of that film are terrific, and other bits of it are rather pretentious, and other bits of it are rather stupid, and other bits of it are rather moving. But I haven't looked at it. Have you?
I think it's wonderful.
Oh, good.
The reception in Britain
was people hated it. Yes, yes, yes. How do I what? Well, people, you want nice reviews, and when people write horrible things about you, you feel horrible. There's no way around that, I'm afraid, and you just have to, you know, be mature. If you could see me crying on the floor, one of my mature phases. It's painful, yes, and it's difficult, and when people write nice things about you, you believe them, and when they write horrible things about you, you think they're bastards. There's no other way, really, is there? But it's part of what I do. You write books and you write films and that, and people write things about you in the newspapers. And I love what I do. I think being a writer is a wonderful job and very interesting. And it's what I've always wanted to do. And there's a price that you pay for that, which is that people write horrible things about you sometimes. And you just have to go through it. You feel shit, and then you carry on because you haven't got any choice. You wouldn't carry on, writing, hoping the next time somebody might like it. And quite soon people forget, and you forget. The very first review of My Beautiful Laundrette was at the Edinburgh Festival, and they hated it. We all sat around in Edinburgh thinking, oh my God, this film's going to be a disaster. And then it got good reviews and people like it, and it's, the film's all right. It kind of exists in the world. So it's just part of your job somehow.
Can I just ask you a final question? What do you think you'll be doing at about midnight tomorrow?
I'll be cheering, probably like you.
We're going to bring this to a close now. I guess you're happy to stay around down here for 5 minutes, just in case a few people didn't get their books signed at the bookshop beforehand.
Fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah, great.
We brought along the Guinness as well.
Great.
I'd like to say thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
To the event tonight. I'm afraid I must also say this too, as it's the last event in this series, apart from the Edmund White, and that is a big thanks to the Departments of Engineering, Physics and Biology, who helped to fund these events throughout the year. And thanks also to the Department of English, who hosted the events, and to the University in general, and to the Arts Council of England. And last of all, thank you to Hanif Qureshi for finishing off the series in Grand Slam.